We're going to have two guests on with us here over the course of the next few minutes. One of them is a parent of a student who attended NIU, Dr. Connie Catalani. And, you know, she's obviously had to deal with quite a difficult circumstance, wondering about the condition of her son. It turned out to be all right. But could arming students actually prevent and contain campus violence? That's a question we want to take a look at this day. And along with Connie, we're also going to be talking with John Lott, who is the author of a book called The Bias Against Guns. Well, again, for this discussion this morning, we want to get into the real serious nature of this. And Dr. Connie Catalani, thank you for being with us today.
Oh, you're welcome.
First of all, I understand that on the day of the shooting at NIU, it took more than an hour for you to reach your son. And why don't you describe kind of what you went through as a parent in that experience?
Well, at first I tried to reassure myself that the ads were that he was okay. And, you know, I tried to reach him by cell phone. He didn't answer. I left a voicemail. I texted him. He didn't answer. And I was watching the coverage on TV. I kept praying. I kept calling the different numbers that they were putting up there as hotlines. And I left messages on, I think, five or six hotlines. Then I started calling all the area hospitals. And, of course, they couldn't tell me anything. And the longer it went on, it didn't seem like an hour. Of course, later on, I figured out that it was an hour. It felt like, you know, a week or two went by where I could not find out if he was okay. And when I did find out, when my son finally was able to text me that he was all right, I was, of course, very relieved and very grateful. And then I started thinking about all the parents that weren't going to get good news, you know, parents that were going to hear that their child was injured or critically ill or you know, had injuries that, you know, were serious and all the, you know, it just was overwhelming. And I became very angry and started ranting about it to the friend I was with. And she was the one who said, why don't you have a press conference? And of course I was completely unfamiliar with how one would go about having a press conference, but she told me, call as many parents as you can. And she would, you know, see about getting the media there. And that's what we did. So on Saturday the 16th, we had a press conference, saying that this is an election year and we want candidates to look at these issues and discuss them in a reasonable fashion. All the other important issues that are on the table in an election year, this has to be one of them.
All right. So kind of in a nutshell, if you could fix what you think is the situation that needs to be fixed, what's your answer here?
I would say, first of all, there's no place for assault weapons in the general public. These are military weapons. And this young man did use an assault weapon. He had a Glock with a very large magazine that he was able to, you know, rapidly change and fire off dozens of shells, dozens of bullets in an extremely short period of time. I've heard it said that in less than 2 minutes he had emptied all his, you know, weapons and also killed himself. I don't know if that's the most accurate, most recent data. There's the arguments that are made about having guns for self-defense or for hunting, you know, are legitimate arguments or legitimate discussions, but these kinds of weapons that are now freely available since the assault weapon ban was ended in 2004, or I should say allowed to lapse. It was the law for a period of time, but it was allowed to lapse in 2004. Now, ordinary citizens can buy military-style assault weapons, meaning high-velocity ammunition, rapid-fire ammunition, guns with a very large capacity, and the only purpose of these kinds of guns is to do maximum damage. They are really weapons of mass destruction, comparable to a suicide bomb, comparable to a hand grenade, and there's no place for them anywhere in ordinary civilian life.
Okay, civilian life, and I think that is the importance here. You're not saying that the military should be restricted from using these.
No, of course not.
Or police officers, if a situation warranted, but
police
but
officers
citizens.
Often don't want to carry these kinds of weapons,
really?
Because of all the problems associated with them.
Okay, and
but
that's,
yes, police officers and military would be the kind of people who could appropriately use these kinds of weapons.
Yeah, is that the only restriction that you would have? I mean, is that fundamentally the law? If you could pick one thing, or are there other things on the agenda? Then?
Well, if there was only one item that would be a top contender.
Yeah, right. Okay.
No, but the other items are, you know, the screening and licensing of guns. I mean, every state has different laws about this. This most recent young man at Northern Illinois, and of course we've all heard there's been multiple shootings since then. There was one this morning, I believe, in Omaha of, I think, 8 people. The shooter is still at large. We don't know any circumstances of it, but this is such common, ordinary news in our world today, which seems completely wrong and unjustifiable to me. But anyway, but back to the Northern shooting, this young man was a good student. Yes, he did have a mental health record, but he was a student in good standing at U of I Champaign. Before that, he was an undergraduate who did well at Northern Illinois. Mental illness is a fact of life in this country and all over the world, and to make these kinds of weapons available is extremely foolish or reckless, or, you know, I would say an abandonment of our charge of taking care of our children and, you know, protecting the safety of those who aren't always able to defend themselves. And what's more vulnerable than a classroom full of children? Even if they're 18 and 19 and 20-year-old children, they're still sitting there paying attention to the lecturer to say, as some people do, that they should be armed and ready in case someone steps onto the stage with a gun. To me, it's foolish. They're not sitting there in a state of military preparedness. They're sitting there supposedly listening and taking notes and learning. So anyway, but the screening, if we need to have a license to drive a car, and if our license to drive a car can be revoked at any time for improper use of that car, we certainly should have similar restrictions on the use of guns. And those who legitimately want to use the guns for purposes that are not endangering the safety of others would be, and I think are, happy to fulfill those kinds of requirements. When gun owners are surveyed in many different surveys, 80% of them want guns to be safely regulated just so that their rights to use them can be protected and it doesn't mm-hmm. become a controversy. But right now, in different states, things like straw sales, where, let's say, a girlfriend pays for the guns that her boyfriend is buying because he won't pass the background check, are allowed. Private sales, once it's bought from a gun owner, the first owner of that gun can sell it to someone else without any record of that sale. Guns can be transported across state lines in many circumstances. There's just way too much freedom. We wouldn't even think of allowing that kind of sales of cars anymore, and we wouldn't even dream of allowing, you know, things with high capacity to do harm, weapons, again, of mass destruction.
Connie, let me ask you a question, though.
To be trafficked in that way.
We know that, that at least in one state, some students are authorized to carry guns on their college campus. I think it's in Arizona. Yeah, you've heard that.
Okay. I've heard it about, I thought it was Utah. And
maybe it's Utah.
And I believe New Mexico. Yeah.
Okay, so what about that? I mean, suppose some students had been permitted to carry a gun on the NIU campus, and maybe one of them could have stopped something like this. What's your thought on that?
I find it almost preposterous to think that students in the auditorium could have done, maybe one of them would have shot the shooter, but I think in the process many other students would have been injured. I'm also an emergency physician. I was mm-hmm. a practicing emergency physician for 16 years, and in all that time, I never saw a shooter or a criminal or a home invader who was injured by a person with a gun. I saw many, many, many people who were, you know, innocent victims of someone who shouldn't have had a gun. Mm-hmm. And I also saw many domestic arguments that unfortunately ended in loss of life or suicide with, a gun that happened to be in the house, and it might have been there legally. But guns provide the opportunity for anger and rage to be expressed much more destructively when they are present.
Then for the self-defense of something like this, huh?
Well, yeah. I mean, I saw, you know, wives that were killed by their husbands in a domestic argument. If the gun hadn't have been there, maybe there would have been fist fights or things like that, but it probably wouldn't have been as easily fatal as it was, in those circumstances. So when I hear the argument that a student, you know, in the audience might have, been able to end this sooner, I highly doubt it. I doubt that a student in the audience would have had a weapon that could have fired 30 rounds in, 20 seconds or something. And by the time they would be fumbling in their backpack to get out their gun and aim it at the shooter, I suspect that they would have been one more casualty, instead of allowed to defend themselves. I mean, in that kind of a situation, people should, drop, hide behind furniture and head for the exits. They shouldn't be sitting there trying to, fire back when someone has that kind of firepower up on a stage.
All right. Well, you know that we were going to ask John Lott to be with us, and we are. He's going to join us here in just a bit, and he is actually the author of a book called The Bias Against Guns and More Guns, Less Crime, and he actually does argue for students to carry guns to make campuses safer. We're going to hear his arguments on this coming up in just a moment. If you're just joining us, Dr. Connie Catalani, again, has a student at NIU. It took her almost an hour to find out the condition of her student. Fortunately, things were okay for her family. And we'll continue our conversation on this important topic coming up in just a moment. Live with me is John Lott. John is a senior research scientist at the University of Maryland, the author of The Bias Against Guns. He's also written More Guns and Less Crime. And John, you're probably at a somewhat of an emotional disadvantage here because, of course, this was in the backyard of us here in Chicago, and all of us are concerned about the welfare of our students. So it's hard to take a step back, but you've been able to do that. What are you really advocating here, John?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm a college professor, and I've been an academic most of my adult life. I have kids in college, and I've talked to a lot of people who've been present at these attacks. I mean, it's hard to think of a more emotional case or where people feel as helpless as they can in this type of situation. I think the thing to do in part, though, is to look at what's common across all these attacks. And in any attack involving more than a few people being harmed, the one common feature, not only here in the United States, but worldwide in Europe and other places, is that these attacks, time after time, are taking place in places where guns are banned by civilians. You know, and it's not just these school shootings, the mall shootings, other types of attacks that have been occurring, keep on occurring where some of the very few places and states where citizens are able to even carry concealed handguns around. It's just, you know, you look at mall shootings, the two that we had last year in Omaha, Nebraska, and Salt Lake City. Lots of malls in both of those cities allowed people to carry permanent concealed handguns, but the attacks occurred in some of the very few places in terms of malls where they were banned. You know, I understand, and the question is, why is that? Why is that the one common feature of these things? And I think there's an obvious reason for that. That's the fact that these places are actually magnets for these attacks. That time after time, these criminals are actually taking it into account when they're deciding where to go and do the attack. And probably the very simplest thing to realize about this is, let's say a criminal was really stalking you or your family. What would they think if you were to put up a sign in front of your house that said this house is a gun-free zone? Would it make it more or less likely that those criminals would then go and choose your house to go and attack you at? And I think most people would realize that that's probably at least a waste of your time at best to put up that type of sign there. And yet that's the type of sign that we see all over the place. And what's happening is these criminals know that they have less to be worried about in those places.
John, the comments that Connie made, it seemed like they were reasonable restrictions, no assault weapons. She's talking about, again, guns that can be used for mass killings like this and the screening and licensing of guns. Where do you stand on that?
Look at the worst public school shootings in the world. They've occurred in Germany over the last 6 years. You had one high school where 17 people were killed, another one where 14 people were killed. Look at the attacks in France or in Finland. I mean, Germany has some of the toughest gun control laws in the world. You know, even the attacks that you've had in Switzerland, the attacks that have occurred in Switzerland, the Canton and Zug, occurred in places in parliament buildings where people were banned just recently, I might add, because they weren't banned up until 99. From carrying their handguns with them. But, you look at these countries, in England and other places where these attacks have occurred, you had 35 people killed at the school in England in the 90s. You had 36 people killed in an attack in Australia. I mean, these places have all the types of gun control laws that are being advocated by the proponents in this case, and more. And yet it didn't stop those attacks from taking place.
No, what happens?
I don't see what, you know, I'm listening to the list, you know, the 50 caliber ban that's being proposed,
yeah,
or the different types of straw purchasing. What would they have done for this particular attack? What would they have done with regard to the attack that occurred in Kirkwood City Council, another gun-free ban place? I mean, there you even had a police officer there. Civilians weren't allowed to have a concealed handgun. But what happens when you even have police, and Israel learned this the hard way with terrorism over time, is that you can have a lot of police, but the terrorists do one of two things. Either they kill the police first, or they wait till they leave. In the Kirkwood place, the police officer was the first person killed in the room there. And the benefit of having permanent concealed handgun is that you don't know, the attacker doesn't know who might be able to defend themselves. and the types of concerns that were raised about bystanders being shot or what have you. You know, we have a quarter of the public school shootings have been stopped in the United States by citizens with guns before uniformed police were able to arrive. It rarely gets attention. Hmm. We've had a university's attacks that have been stopped. We have attacks on the street. There was a public shooting in Memphis last year that was stopped by permanent concealed handgun holders, time after time. And yet I cannot find one of these attacks that have been stopped where a bystander has been accidentally shot by one of the permit holders. In fact, in the vast majority of cases, it's not even necessary for the permit holder to actually fire their gun. Simply being there and being able to point their gun at the attacker has been sufficient to cause the attacker to stop the attack.
Hmm. All right, let's continue our conversation. And both of our guests have heard the comments of each other that were made this morning. Dr. Connie, as you listen to those, and John's on the line with us as well, what are your thoughts in response to what he had to say?
Well, I appreciate his, what sounds like very thoughtful, very thorough research. If the guns that were preventative on the scene of some of these incidents were, in fact, a completely neutral item, in other words, if they never caused any problem before or after, then maybe there would be some validity to that, in my opinion, sort of like having your EpiPen in your pocket in case you had a bad allergic reaction. However, guns do not tend to be neutral objects when they're in a home, when they're in a, a car. They are often explored or found by younger children. Children are very, almost always know if there is a gun in the house or in the car or if their parents own one. So they tend to be used in domestic incidents. Kids, you know, find them and play with them and injure each other or themselves. Teenagers or young adults who are depressed are more often likely to use a gun if it's available, as well as depressed adults. So a gun in the home, a gun in the dorm room, a gun in the car is not a neutral item that can be pulled out like an EpiPen and used in case of an emergency, and other than that, it does no harm. Guns are, you know, much more, you know, not to be punny, but a loaded weapon that can cause all kinds of collateral damage just by their very presence. So that kind of research, I think, has to be factored into this kind of a discussion. I think of college campuses as especially full of, you know, sort of volatile young people, teenagers and adults who, you know, might be experimenting with drinking, sometimes tend to get more angry. There's certainly, you know, high rates of depression and stress on college campuses, all the kind of places where I wouldn't want a gun to be available. If that gun acted as a deterrent, you know, on an occasion here and there for a crime, and yet in the, you know, over the life of its history in that person's possession also was available for a possible suicide or to, you know, make a point during an argument, or if it made that student more vulnerable to a robbery in their dorm room because it was known that they had a gun, that then it would cancel out any beneficial effects of having that gun, in my opinion, in their possession. Hmm.
All right. Well, let's give John an opportunity to respond to that. John, your thoughts?
Sure. Well, I mean, you can go to the Centers for Disease Control website, their mortality, morbidity reports, and you get an idea of the number of accidental deaths involving kids. And in 2004, for example, there were 28 children under the age of 10 who died from accidental gunshots. You had about 60 under age 15, all ages under 15, who died from accidental gunshots in the United States. Obviously, it'd be better if those types of numbers were zero rather than 28 or 60. But I think a little bit of perspective is needed here. First of all, when you go through and actually look at each of those cases, the vast majority of those accidental gunshots are by adult males, usually in their mid to late 20s, who have criminal histories, in fact, violent criminal histories, and it's illegal for them to even own the gun to begin with. These are not children usually getting a hold of a gun and accidentally firing it, despite the impression that is often portrayed in, like, the public service ads that were put out by the Clinton administration. But, you know, beyond that, if we go and look at the behavior of concealed carry permit holders around the country, these people are extremely law-abiding. They lose their permits for any type of firearms-related violation, either accidental shots or harming other people in any way, at hundreds or thousands of 1 percentage point. In fact, the vast majority of those hundreds or thousands of 1 percentage point involve one particular type of violation, and and that is accidentally carrying a concealed handgun into a restricted area where you have a gun-free zone, either it's an airport or a school or something like that. Probably the most famous of those cases is Barry Switzer, some years ago, the former coach of the Dallas Cowboys, that accidentally carried his permanent concealed handgun with him when he was late for a team plane at the Dallas airport. But, you know, there's so many fears that people have about these things that I think are just not represented when you actually go and look at the numbers and the facts there. And the question becomes, when we want to try to go and pass these different laws, like these gun-free zones that we have around the places, I understand the desire to go and try to do good. And it seems so simple. If we just ban guns from particular areas, that's going to go and make people safer. The problem is, and the question you have to ask with regard to these gun control laws generally, is who is likely to obey these laws? If it turns out that it's basically the law-abiding good citizens who obey them and not the criminals, then you can have the opposite occurring of what you'd like to have happen. Rather than going and making places safer for victims, what you unintentionally end up doing is actually making them safer for the criminals who are thinking about doing these attacks. And whether it be at the Appalachian Law School, it was stopped by two law students who ran to their cars and got their permanent concealed handguns and brought them back in and stopped the attacker without having to fire a shot, or things like Pearl, Mississippi High School attack, the first of the public school shootings that occurred in October 97, in which an assistant principal there, a former Marine who had a permit to carry a concealed handgun, and apparently regularly carried his handgun with him up until the end of 95 when we had the Safe School Zone Act being passed, had to run literally a mile total to get his handgun from his car, came back, pointed his gun at the attacker, and held him at point-blank range for over 5.5 minutes before the police arrived. The attacker was in the process of leaving the high school there and going to the middle school across the street when the assistant principal stopped him. Or Edinburgh, Pennsylvania, or Paducah, Kentucky, or Santee, California, where you have citizens with guns stopping these attacks before uniformed police were able to arrive on the scene at these different locations.
Yeah, you know what? Just for time's sake here, let's do this. Let me just give you both about 1 minute, 60 seconds to kind of wrap things up here. And I'm going to ask John again, you to go first, but if you can, try to contain it to around 60 seconds. Bottom line, what would you say? I know you must sympathize with Dr. Catalani as a parent and also as a person who has worked at a university. I mean, you understand the dynamic of what happened at Northern Illinois. You have to sympathize with her situation. What would you say to her in conclusion here?
Yeah. I mean, I've talked to lots of people, I mean, as part of my research, who have been at these attacks. And it's hard for me to think of a more terrifying situation where you're there helpless. And the best you can do in some of these attacks, like the Kirkwood case, is just to throw a chair or something like that at the attacker, or try to throw books that happen in these cases. And how helpless and how futile those attempts to stop those things are. I can't think of anything that's more terrifying. The problem is you have to ask, what is the one common feature across these? And the thing that's frustrating to me is that time after time, these keep on occurring in gun-free zones. I can't get the media to mention in their news reports that these are in gun-free zones, because when I try to do it, they say, well, that would be taking a stand politically on this. And yet the media, time after time, goes into things that I think are largely irrelevant, these made-up features on guns, these so-called assault weapons, which is a type of definition for guns that didn't even exist more than 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wish one time the media in their news report would say, you know, this is yet another time where we ban guns in an area, and that's where it's cooked. I'll give you one last thing, you know, the combine shooters. Few people know that these shooters were writing the state legislature asking them not to pass the concealed handgun law that eventually got passed many years later. And in fact, their day that they chose to do the attack was the very day that the Colorado state legislature was planning on voting on the concealed handgun law. And the thing that they objected to most was the fact that that law was going to let people carry permanent concealed handguns on school property.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Connie, you've heard him now, and why don't you go ahead and give your final comments on this?
Well, I'm fascinated by the fact that I think in some ways we're really talking about two different topics. The NIU parents and alumni that I, you know, did this press conference with,
yeah.
Our biggest concern was that there's no discussion about any of these issues. You know, I mean, these things are not on any of the political candidates' short list of topics that need discussion. We are saying this needs to be discussed. I think the kind of research that Dr. Ladd is doing needs to be discussed, as well as the kind of research that I see that says 32 people die a day because of handguns, whether it's accidental, whether it's criminal, whatever. I would think a first step that maybe Dr. Ladd and I would both agree is these assault weapons, these rapid-firing weapons, don't belong in the general public. If we're talking about people being allowed to carry weapons or not, which, of course, as you all know, I'm not enthused about, I don't think anybody's talking about them having a Glock with a 33-bullet magazine in it, in their backpack or in their pocket or in their purse. I think, you know, that there's definitely points of commonality here that should be discussed, and yet none of the political candidates this year are discussing them. And I want to read a quote that Dr. Lott might recognize. It says, "First, we believe in absolutely gun-free, zero-tolerance, totally safe schools. That means no guns in America's schools, period, with the rare exception of law enforcement officers or trained security personnel. We believe America's schools should be as safe as America's airports. You can't talk about, much less take, bombs and guns onto airplanes. Such behavior in our schools should be prosecuted just as certainly as such behavior in our airports is prosecuted." This quote is from 1999, in the aftermath of the Columbine High School massacre, by the NRA Executive Vice President Wayne LaPierre. That was his public statement following the Columbine High School massacre. Since then, the waters have become so muddied, so, you know, churned up in the discussion between the NRA, between Professor Lott's work, between the people who are, you know, in favor of more restrictions on guns, who are, you know, following things like the Illinois Council Against Handgun Violence's work, the work of the mayors that I can't remember the name of that organization, the Brady Campaign. And yet, there's lots of commonality here. I think if the discussion continued and was out on the table in this election year, we'd find that there are some things that almost everyone agrees to. I think 80% of gun owners in the surveys that I've seen would like to have the rules more strictly enforced. Well, the surveys that I've seen say that they would. They don't want criminals out there, people with long histories of mental health issues, able to buy guns. And yet, if you cross a state border, that, you know, the laws change right away. People can order things through the mail. They can go to a gun show and buy things without any kind of background check or permit. Those kinds of things need to be tightened up. And if the only people carrying guns.
Okay. Well, listen, I want to thank you both for giving us time today. And I know that this conversation could go on, and maybe between you two, it will at some point. But thanks so much for both giving us time, mm-hmm. both of you. Dr. Connie, we appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much.
And John Lott, thank you very much, Professor.
Thanks.
At 20 minutes after 8 o'clock, and we will give you links to more information on this if you'd like to get that. And along with that, Mom, we'll see what we have time for in calls coming up in just a moment.